radio for extreme times. This is A View from Space with the Spaceman on Talk Radio AM 640.
I'm the guy we call the Spaceman. This is ABFS. I'd like to welcome you in if you're driving around town right now listening to AM 640. I welcome you in. Or if you're maybe right now at work listening to AM 640 via this AM 640 app, I welcome you in too. Or if you're listening to me right now on Shaw Direct, channel 865, picking up the show that way, I welcome you in. Or if you're listening to me on your 3 or 4G personal communication device via the Stream the World software, I welcome you in. And now available too, free on Apple Music. Or maybe you're what some call sitting in the best seat in the house. Your Mac, your PC, logged on to 640toronto.com, picking up the live audio streaming there at that website. I welcome you in wherever you are in the world. I welcome you in. By far the most asked question of me with my emailers is Donald Trump an Illuminati member? The answer is yes. An emphatic yes. People say, then how come he's positioned as being the voice of the poor and the middle class behind this populist movement? It's simple. It's the old Illuminati trick, because they knew nothing new. It's the same old all the time and repeated throughout history. It's Satan versus Satan, and the winner parades around as the savior. And in this case, it's Donald Trump for the temporary savior now. Now, the elites who control all political leaders at all powerful places in the world are using Donald Trump as the man, like Brexit in Britain, who will appear to do the people's will. That's what Brexit is doing, too. It appears as though it's the people's will. And they want some changes. They're going to let them have it. Because everybody's sick of the special interest groups, the elites, padding their pockets. They're sick and tired of it. That's the way it's been for so long, and everyone is sick to death of it. Enter, right on time, the man who's put there in that place to fill that role. The man who will play the role as being the nationalist. Not a globalist at all, which he really is. See, he's the wolf in the hen house dressed up as a chicken. But this populist wave that's going on around the world, notice it's going everywhere, and the two greatest economies in the world, Britain and America now, have these two disruptions for the world global economy, and it's supposedly wavering, even prompting Zuckerman, the Facebook boy, out into the Illuminati-controlled mass media this week, saying he's very disturbed at this movement away from globalization and the connectiveness in the world, and it has to change. Because that's where we are headed. You see, it's already a done deal. And this populist movement around the world sort of reminds me of the Arab Spring a few years ago, which was doomed to fail and did fail and fail miserably. So will this. It will be showing no country can exist being protectionist and closing her borders. See, globalism is already here, waiting in the shadows to rule overtly, out in the open. But they just have to prove to the people of the world that it's the only way. So, what is the other way? Closing your borders and being a nationalist. Hoarding what you have. Making the best deal for you and not the collective whole. So Donald Trump has been picked to play that role. He is an Illuminati member. His ancestry goes back to Germany. His real name is Drumpf. Last name, Drumpf. Also, he has married his daughter into the Kushner clan. Now, the Kushners are owners, multi-billionaire real estate investors and developers of one of the biggest real estate companies in the world. For instance, it owns the most single expensive piece of real estate in all the world. It costs the most of any property per square foot, period. I'm referring to 666, yeah, I know, 666 Fifth Avenue North, right across the street from the Rockefeller Plaza. Tenants, Uniqlo, Japanese, casual wear designers, Hollister, also there, the American lifestyle brand, parent company Abercrombie & Fitch. Also, it's filled with many huge law firms and, wouldn't you know it, investment bank firms. So you see, it is the billionaires secretly, clandestinely dressing one of their boys up as the populist hero. And here's another news name that was in the Illuminati-controlled mass media news all this week, really. I do know why. Eugenie Bouchard, another Illuminati kid. It's absolutely incredible. You know the story, of course. How could you avoid it? They're so invasive with their control of the media and the information. Has a date with a stranger over a loss in a Super Bowl game and elects to go on the date. And of course, it was all publicized. And now there's going to be a second date, we've heard. Why? Eugenie Bouchard is the daughter of an investment banker in Montreal, set by the cabal, the British banking cabal. She has a fraternal twin sister, Beatrice, who's just a few minutes older than her. She also has a couple of younger siblings, her sister Charlotte and brother William. Notice the names? She and her twin sister are named after Prince Andrew's daughters, by the way, Princess Beatrice of York and Princess Eugenie of York. Her sister Charlotte's named after Charlotte Casragi, daughter of Montesquieu, Royal Caroline, Princess of Hanover. And William, her brother's named after Prince William, Duke of Cambridge. I'm saying the next king. So you see, it's just one of the Illuminati kids getting a little publicity, selling the names out there, just making sure you understand that the elite are our gods and the ones to watch and be worshipped, and you will follow them and only them. So Trump and Bouchard are part of the secret bloodline that's been snaking through the centuries, controlling every empire that's arisen. They change last names, oh sure, to hide identity, and marry into each other's families, first cousins, even closer sometimes, to keep the power. See, the Illuminati never have done anything new, ever. They just repeat history. The past is our future. I'm a student of history. I go back and I see it. And I see it happening again, repeating again. So, there's nothing new under the sun. It's simply history repeating itself. You see, because the Illuminati believe they will finally do one more morph of an empire. And it will be this time a truly global empire that comes out of it. You see, the key, the past is our future. What do you think they mean by the phrase, back to the future, anyway? This is Spaceman on Talk Radio, AM 640. This is a view from space, and I'm just getting started. I think I call space. It's talk radio, AM 640. Emails, that's the only way I communicate, obviously. By the opening, you heard that. Space at 640toronto.com or spaceman at 640toronto.com. And thanks for the one that you've sent. They start rocking the inbox way before the show begins. Now, because it is imperative that you, in order for you to completely understand what I'm going to present to you tonight, you must know the definition of really just two words. That's all. And these two words are the word crypto and the word Judaizer. Now, crypto means someone who belongs to a secret organization or has a secret idea that is not what they seem. Like they can be, let's say a crypto-Nazi, believing in, you know, the Fuhrer over all, domination of the world by one group, and one group legislating what everyone else has to do, but doesn't let on they are. Crypto. Someone who is something hidden that you don't see. The other word is Judaizer. Now, Judaizer has a Christian origin. Strange, isn't it? It's taken from the Greek verb iudaizo, meaning living according to Jewish customs. Now, this word is widely known mostly for the single used in the New Testaments. It appears in the King James Version of the Galatians chapter 2, verse 14, where Paul publicly challenges Peter for compelling Gentile believers to Judaize. This event is also known as the incident at Antioch, if you're a biblical scholar, to knowledgeable Christians. According to the Concise Oxford Dictionary of World Religions, this word includes groups like Jewish Christians, Cartesimans, Ethiopian Christians, descendants of English Puritanism, like the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and others who claim the necessity of obedience to the Mosaic laws, which are found in the first five books of the Christian Old Testament. Though this is something likely disputed by members belonging to these groups, especially by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, also known as the Mormons. Known as the Mormons, probably. To them, the word Judaizers is a negative word. It's a very bad thing. By the way, in America, the Republican Party had a Mormon run for president of the United States not long ago, a few elections ago. His name was, of course, Mitt Romney. Now, Romney was named after the hotel magnate, J. Willard Marriott, his father's best friend. Yes, the Marriott hotel chain is owned by the Mormons. As a matter of fact, it's the only hotel chain in the entire world that's privately owned by the family. It's the elite rich and powerful, you see, who create religions, is what I'm getting at here. They've always been in power. In 1952, Mitt Romney's father, a former governor of Michigan, was CEO of American Motors. And his father's cousin, Mitt Romney, was quarterback for the Chicago Bears from 1925 until 1929. Now, the founder of the Mormon religion was Joseph Smith and his inner circle of family members. They were polygamists and also sun worshippers. This was an original family of Cain idea. Because, you see, this is where this bloodline, as I said in the opening, snaking through history, controlling all of the empires, is. They believe that they are half man, half God. From Cain, not Seth, who was the replacement for Abel, of course, being human versus human, or human and human. With Seth. And that's where you and I are from, the unwashed, the uninitiated. But the gods, no, they're from another tribe, Cain tribe. With the Cainite seed, which was Satan's seed, in Eve, because Eve had twins. One Cain and one Abel. And of course, you know the biblical story. Cain kills Abel, later replaced by Seth, so that man has a father. Cain begat, supposedly, the elite only. The half-god, half-man. The half-man part coming from Eve, the half-god part coming from the satanic entity in the garden that provided the seed. The seed has snaked its way through the sands of time and are still here and in power today and almost ready to seize it all, pounce on their final empire, what they call the New World Order, the final empire that this world will ever see. Lamech was the very first ever polygamist, by the way. He's the sixth generation descendant of Cain. Genesis 4:18 to prove that to you. His father was named Methuselah and was responsible for the Song of the Sword. He's also the first polygamist, taking two wives, as I said, Ada and Tesla. Yeah, I know, it sounds like Tesla. Tubal-Cain is one of his sons. The Song of the Sword is an ancient story. In it, the last part of the tale of Lamech. Genesis 4, verses 23 to 24, takes the form of a brief poem which refers back to the curse of Cain. In that poem, Lamech's stance resembles that of a supreme warrior, able to avenge himself absolutely. And no explanation of who Lamech supposedly killed is ever even given. Some researchers, though, have proposed that it's connected to the invention of the sword, the world's very first weapon. Since his son Tubal-Cain was the very first blacksmith, which is, of course, the science of melting rock to extract metal to make buildings, swords, aircraft, bombs, or for good. That's the reason the poem is often referred to as the Song of the Sword. Of course, it's exactly the same today as it was then, because there is nothing new. Today, the greatest weapons belong to the same family of the Cainite bloodline. They are the jet fighters, the guided missiles, the weapon systems, the weapons of mass destruction. This bloodline's father, who is Satan, has the same plan as he has had since the earliest of times, and that is to exact revenge on the true God by destroying all of the true God's creation. That includes you and me. And this earth. Nuclear power possibly has the weapon to do it now. This bloodline has successfully obscured the truth by hiding it in religions that have been mixed inextricably with what they call mythology, which is really their lies about their father and God, Lucifer. They're now in the process of pitting those major religions against one another. This manifests itself in what you know as the global war on terror, which will morph into the Third World War. And this coming global conflict will be the use that is used to force the world's population into accepting their final kingdom here on Earth. That will be run by the willing king, who will then be possessed by Satan himself, and will be the culmination of thousands of years' work toward this goal. this one global empire under one king with one religion, one people. The other religions twisted and contorted by them will no longer be needed. So let's see how today's religions have been altered then. It's next on Talk Radio AM 640. Spaceman AVFS back with more right after this break. I'm the guy they call Space. It's a view from space. Talk Radio AM 640. Emails to spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. E.H. writes, hey, this religion is not Mormon. He writes about the Seventh-day Adventists. But it's pretty strict about things like full immersion, baptism, dietary guidelines, things like that. The Mormons are like a cult started by a man who wants a lot of wives. So he invented a visitation by the angel Moroni. Get it? You have to be a moron, Moroni, to buy it. Stay well and thanks for research. Also, how are you able to afford 4 hours of radio time every week? Just curious because I know how much ads cost on radio nowadays. Well, EH, they pay me to talk. I don't pay to talk. Now, let me just run through the words that you have to know the meanings to tonight to really get where I'm coming from with religion being the use to control masses of people by a few. Crypto. Crypto, the exact meaning, is a person who adheres to or belongs secretly to a party, a sect, or other group. Someone who belongs to a secret society, but doesn't overtly tell you they do. Judaizers. Christian origin. Taken from the Greek verb eudaizo, meaning live according to Jewish customs. Publicly, Paul challenges Peter for compelling Gentiles, the believers, to Judaize. This is in Galatians, one time where it's actually even mentioned in the King James Version of the Bible. So, this new empire that you and I are now living in, this is known as the American Empire. Now, the empire that is going to be the penultimate empire, the second last one, I believe, is this one. This one is about to crash to allow the new and final one to arise. It's the story of the myth of the phoenix. They crash it to allow the new one to arise. It's the phoenix story being acted out, the scarlet and golden magical phoenix bird, synonymous with rebirth and recovery, especially after calamity. Originally from the traditions of ancient Phoenicia, the original homeland of the tribe of Cain. Phoenix bird has a counterpart in many other cultures. The phoenix is said to have an entrancing song, captivating enough to make even the sun stop to listen. Now, if the phoenix is injured, it can heal itself. Think of, when I say the word phoenix, think of an empire. Think of a global entity, or as the world was then, like the Roman Empire, the Grecian Empire. If the phoenix is injured, if the empire is injured, it can heal itself and enjoy a lifespan of 500 or more, sometimes 1,000 years, just like the empires. Considered a lonely creature that cannot reproduce, and there's only one of them at a time, and it's only one of a kind. So when the phoenix reaches the end of its life, the empire reaches the end of its life, it's said to build itself a nest of aromatic spices such as cinnamon and myrrh. It then sets the nest and itself on fire and is burned to ashes. Shortly, the phoenix rises again and begins its life anew. In some traditions, this new phoenix gathers up the ashes of the old and takes them to Heliopolis to offer them to the sun god. Of course, the sun god being Lucifer, the god of light. The American Empire, set up by Cain's descendants after the Second World War, is really the lion's whelp. The lion, of course, represents the line of Judah. Jacob assembles his sons before his death and speaks to them in a combination of blessings, curses, a warning, a psychological assessment, a parable, a recollection, and hope. He speaks to each son separately in poetic language that a few researchers associate with the ancient tribal songs and memories. Judah, the fourth son of Leah, described with these famous words, "Judah, like a lion's whelp, on prey, my son, have you grown? He crouches, lies down like a lion, like the king of beasts. Who dare rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet." Now, the celebrated metaphor of Judah as a lion's whelp, a young offspring, is one of strength and daring. The Lion of Judah has become a favorite motif in Jewish art and folklore and has acquired messianic associations. I said, Messiah, the symbol of the Lion of Judah, is a lion with a crown on its head, after all. Tell me, where have you seen that before? Why, it's the symbol of the family that now resides in Buckingham Palace, who's also claimed to be descended from the house of David, from which the King James Version of the Bible states the King of Kings to come must be from the house of David. They're, in fact, imposters, I tell you now, and are of the tribe of Dan, who is really the family of Cain. It's the Spaceman. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. I've got more, a lot more, right after this.
We got to call Space. It's a view from Space. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails to Spaceman at 640Toronto.com or Space at 640Toronto.com. DB writes, "It always starts with the Republic, then democracy, then communism. The King of Kings is coming to fix that. The sinless dictator." RG writes, "I believe in the story of what you're saying about Cain and Abel. Seth, however, after Noah's flood, how did the bloodline of Cain survive the flood? Supposed to have wiped that evil bloodline out, and other races from Noah's sons populating throughout the world. Although our other cultures have similar accounts of a flood," which could be my answer. This will be a long sort of a discussion for another time. Hope to hear it again one night. I, for sure, am going to point out how the bloodline of Cain did escape the flood. One word now, and I'll move on to tonight's topic, but I can cover it in depth at some other evening. That name? Nama. Just do a little study on Nama. N-A-M-A-H. And I will definitely tackle that conundrum for a lot of people, not me, on how Cain's bloodline actually slipped through the flood. IJ writes, "So if every empire falls, what is stopping the final empire from falling then? Wouldn't it always be the cycle of rise and fall? What don't we know?" Well, that's one thing you didn't take into consideration and think it completely through, IJ. When there is one final empire, there are no enemies. There's no one left to fight the power. So it would, conceivably, and this is what they plan, to be heaven on earth. No wars. Only peace.
under one ruler, one people, one religion. So there would be no opposition. There's nothing new under the sun. It's simply history repeating itself, and we will do it until this final empire arises that will have now consumed the world, because the other empires that have come before have not. There's always been a part of the world that's left out. This final one will include all. So, this bloodline always ends up top, always controlling. They're the one who takes empires down and sets the next one up to replace it, always ensuring they're in control with the correct and best weapon for their chosen side so that they end up on top. And each next system is set up, designed so that it keeps them there. Their latest threat is this global financial crisis where they said we're too big to fail. You need them to create jobs for you. They're not cleverly disguised as hiding behind the new name. The very benign sounding private sector. A private public partnership. Give us what the people own that makes a lot of money so we control even more. And you can keep that which doesn't make any money. We're now being told that anything we, the people, own, you can't afford it. So you better let the private sector take it over. Or you're all doomed and the system will crash. Well, it's going to crash anyway. They're going to see to that. You can see that now, can't you? They want it to. They're going to cause it. That's why they had the chaos candidate, now the disruptor president in the world's greatest economy. Then their plan is to set up the final empire here on Earth throughout. After World War III. This ancient bloodline of Cain comes from the tribe of Dan, as I covered pretty extensively last week, and put a pretty good case, I thought, forward for you to get that. During the days of the biblical Great Exodus, a group separated from Moses went up to the north. This group was the 13th tribe. The tribe of Dan. Millions went and settled in the European and Scandinavian areas. From there, they spread out to other parts of the world, conquering the countries, spreading their Anunnaki seed, and replacing the conquered people's traditions with their own serpent culture. The serpent you see very extensively displayed, by the way, lately in the Illuminati-controlled mass media via the Alfa Romeo car ads. You'll see a little green snake, the Alfa Romeo car logo on their decal on their car. The snake's right there. The Old Covenant in Christianity is complex and controversial, but most traditional Christians believe a lot has been replaced with the law of Christ. Some believe all has been replaced. So a person who has Judaized refers to a Christian who has accepted the necessity of still sticking to the Mosaic laws or to specific laws that are believed to be superseded, like circumcision, Sabbath observance, observance of the Passover, same-sex marriage. Get it? If Judaizers play a major role in the formation and establishment of the Roman Catholic Church, is it possible that the Roman Catholic Church was a Jewish Kabbalist project from the beginning? You see, there is, in fact, a long and fascinating history of Jewish infiltration in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, when I say Jewish, I mean the Kabbalist Jews. Jews who are not Jews. Who belong to that secret society. You know, the one that's flashed about in Hollywood, not recently, but has been. The little red string tied around the wrist of a very famous star. That goes back to the Bible days. Of the one that's preferred out of the womb and gets the heritage, gets all of the family's wealth. The Roman Catholic Church, by clever design, perceived as a Gentile institution. If Roman Catholicism was a project of Kabbalist Jews for the purpose of subverting Christianity, it's conceivable then that this Judaized church has functioned for nearly 2,000 years as a covert branch of Kabbalism. Judaism, whose handlers gradually and imperceptibly twisted and contorted Western Christianity to what we've got today with the many different watered-down and changed Bibles that have been printed, then was possible during the vigilant period of the early church when only priests, you see, were allowed to even see the words in the Bible and were able to read. It was also a period of time in Christianity when ecumenical councils were the religious policemen and charged people with heresy and sentenced them to death sometimes. At the present time, I think you can safely say that the Roman Catholic Church is merely a front for Kabbalistic Freemasonry to fool those who would be true believers into the coming messianic kingdom of the Antichrist. Because you see, the Kabbalists aren't Jews at all. The Kabbalists are into Enochian magic. Enoch, the book of Enoch, filled with black magic rituals on how to get your way on this third dimension through demonic spirits intervening for you, casting the right spells, contacting the right demons. So yes, there's a lot of evidence that many of the pseudo-Christian religions were founded by Kabbalist Jews. The founder of Mormonism, another Judaized version of Christianity, was Joseph Smith, who was a practitioner of the Kabbalah. Smith surrounded himself with 12 apostles, just like Christ, of which was his closest colleagues, Jewish Kabbalists. Orson Hyde was one. Alexander Niebuhr. Niebuhr was one of the first Jewish persons to join the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Bauer, by the way, was also the name used by the powerful Kabbalist-believing Rothschild family. Alexander Niebuhr could very well be a Rothschild bloodline member, I believe was. Niebuhr, you see, means Bauer. Lance Owens wrote of Alexander Niebuhr's ultimate, intimate knowledge of the Kabbalah and the strong influence it had on Joseph Smith. Here's what he wrote. That Alexander Niebuhr brought a knowledge of the Kabbalah to Nauvoo has been mentioned in several studies of the period. For instance, Newell and Avery note in their biography of Emma Smith through Alexander Niebuhr, Joseph Smith, founder of Church of Latter-day Saints, had access to ancient Jewish rites called Kabbalism. He not only knew something of the Kabbalah, but apparently possessed a collection of original Jewish Kabbalistic works in Nauvoo, and is all documented in material almost totally overlooked by most people who research Mormonism. It's the Spaceman. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. There's more right after this break. I'm the guy that calls Space to View from Space on Talk Radio, AM 640. Tonight, religions are really twisted by the elite to control man. Alexander Niebuhr, I was pointing out before the break, brought a knowledge of the Kabbalah
to Joseph Smith. And Niebauer, a lot like Bauer, Bauer is the original name of the Rothschild family. The elite rich playing. J.A. writes by email, space@640toronto.com or spaceman@640toronto.com. Space, here's a tip. Maybe you know this already. You mentioned the Seventh-day Adventists. My mother dabbled with that group back in the early 70s. They grew out of the Millerite cult in the mid-1800s while awaiting Armageddon that failed to occur. So they latched on to the writings of a self-proclaimed prophet and her inspired writings by the name where is his email here? Walter Ray. Now, the book's published in the early 80s. It's called The White Lie, and it really shows the interest and how they can twist a religion around. So anyone familiar with the history and personality of Joseph Smith, if you've researched the founder of the Mormons, the prophet who restored the secret knowledge and rituals conveyed to Adam, so he says, translated the works of Abraham, Enoch, and Moses, and retranslated Genesis. Question that he would have been interested in the original version of this Jewish occult tradition. And here, in Niebauer, a man that told him of the Kabbalah was a man who could share a version of that knowledge with him. Whatever the reason for the similarities, it should be remembered that in the Hermetic Kabbalist world, it really parallels Joseph Smith's vision of God in almost all ways. Not only might Joseph Smith have been interested in this with his own restoration of the ancient sun-worshipping beliefs, and maybe Niebauer, who was on a religious quest from Judaism to the Kabbalah that led home to Nauvoo, Illinois, where, of course, Joseph Smith famously began the Mormonist cult, and interwove the Kabbalistic belief system along with Joseph Smith's ideas into this new religion called Mormonism. Really an old one disguised in a place called America. Why America? Because it was America, not like Europe, where you couldn't have your own religion. You could legally invent new religions in the New World. That's one of the reasons that America became what she did. The New World. Whatever the reason for the similarities, if you remember that the Hermetic Kabbalistic world view parallels Joseph Smith's vision of God in almost everywhere, then not only might Joseph Smith have been interested in this material, but he would have recognized how similar this sacred secret tradition was with what he thought was his own restoration of ancient truth. And maybe, just maybe, his mentor, Niebauer, on a religious quest also from Judaism and the Kabbalah, Europe and England, to Christianize and Mormonize in a new place called America, saw, or even amplified maybe, that intrinsic sympathy on his explications of the tradition for Joseph Smith. So, most certainly, the first text Joseph Smith would have confronted was the Zohar, the great heart of the Kabbalah. This is one of the works Niebauer cited repeatedly as the central text of the Kabbalah. And it's the key book to any individual with Kabbalistic interests that they would have in their library. Every Kabbalist must know the Zohar. If Niebauer had read to Joseph from any single text or explained Kabbalistic concepts contained in the principal book, the Zohar would have been the book used. This explains why in 1844, Joseph Smith, in what may be his single greatest speech ever,
that he gave containing the most important public statement of his theosophical vision, apparently quotes almost word for word from the first section of the Kabbalah Zohar. Smith's other Jewish apostle and close colleague, Orson Hyde, one of the co-founders of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, made a trip to Jerusalem in the 1830s to dedicate the restoration of Israel to the Jews. According to Ivan Barrett's Joseph Smith and the Restoration, he wrote this: "In 1823, only a handful of Jews lived in Palestine, and those who did had no rights under Turkish rule. The roots of Zionism in the Jewish communities of Europe were barely stirring, and the thought of Jews gathering at all was virtually unheard of, let alone a return of the Jews to the land of Palestine. But from that very time on, the spiritual stirrings of the Zionist movement began in earnest. God was about to give to special keys to modern prophets, as he had done with the ancient ones, keys to move the nations." In 1831, only a year after the church was organized by Joseph Smith, that's the Church of Latter-day Saints, another young man with a prophetic call by the name of Orson Hyde, Jewish Kabbalistic ancestry, was confirmed as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints by the prophet Joseph. When Joseph Smith laid his hand on him as a blessing, this is what Joseph Smith said: "In due time, thou shalt go to Jerusalem, the land of thy fathers, and be a watchman unto the house of Israel. And by thy hands shall the Most High do a great work, which shall prepare the way and greatly facilitate the gathering of that people." You know who Charles Taze Russell was? Find out next. You've got connections to another religion here. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. This is ABFS. I'm Space. Got a comment or critique of the show? Just want to say where in the world you're listening to ABFS from. Talk Radio, AM 640. Just simply email me, spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. D writes, "So how and where do the Seventh-day Adventists fit in?" What I'm explaining is this. Religions controlled by the elite rich to control masses of people. Religion is the best controller there is, other than fear, of course. But you don't have to constantly threaten with a religion to get the control. With fear, you do. So you see, this is where all of the world's religions have been twisted to control the masses, with the elite rich always have controlled the masses. I've just been telling you how the Church of the Latter-day Saints, they're actually sun worshippers. So is the Roman Catholic Church. Sun worshippers, when you get right down to the bottom of it. Now, Charles Taze Russell asked you who he is before the break. Born to a Scottish-Irish pair. Were the founder of the Jehovah Witnesses. Controlled the Jehovah Witnesses' biggest way to communicate, their Watchtower magazine. He founded that in 1879, which evolved into the Jehovah Witnesses' religious cult. Charles Taze Russell was strongly influenced by the teachings of the Seventh-day Adventists, an anti-Trinitarian cult of the Arian school, which observes the Jewish Sabbath. According to the Watchtower Observer, Charles Taze Russell, an elite rich man, by the way, taught that the Jewish people and nations have a leading role in the divine plan for man. Accordingly, during the year 1910, he spoke to vast Jewish audiences, comforting them according to the scripture. Isaiah 40, verse 2. Remember, Israel didn't become a state until 1948. This was 38 years before that. Yes, a hidden 11. He encouraged them not to join the various churches of today, but to wait for the fulfillment of the many Old Testament promises that they would be blessed as a nation. While they were yet a scattered and dispersed people, the Jews, he said, upon the basis of these promises, that they would be regathered to Palestine and established as an independent nation. Charles Taze Russell was seen as a Christian Zionist, often invited to speak before Orthodox Jewish groups. Also, his views on Zionism been hailed by the likes of former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now again the Prime Minister. Former United Nations Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick also. Charles Taze Russell also promotes the Rothschild-funded ecumenical agenda of the Jehovah Witnesses Watchtower magazine, the Scottish type of Illuminatism that created the early Watchtower Society, has always practiced Enochian magic from Kabbalistic writings of Enoch. Remember from the Be Wise as Serpents book that knowing the Watchtowers are the key to Enochian magic, the same type of winged sun disk that Charles Taze Russell used for his symbolism was all used on the magic. Two phrases that were popular among Satanists who practiced Enochian magic in Rumley's day were Millennial Dawn and Golden Age. J.P. Morgan, the Rothschilds' representatives in the United States, set up a trust fund to unite various Christian denominations. Charles Taze Russell praises this in his January 1st, 1911 Watchtower magazine. Mr. Morgan's well-known business capacity, I'm talking about the elite rich here, exhibited in connection with financial trusts, encourages many to believe that he will accomplish the desired end in connection with the movement. More and more, all denominations are craving a religious trust or federation, and are becoming more and more willing to sacrifice doctrine and principles formerly held dear in order to accomplish the federation. In other words, all religions slowly but surely coming into one. Except that is for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They will be the ones that will be separated from the rest. The monotheistic religions, the three, to be illegal, banned as the problems that have plagued this world since the beginning of time. So, not content with the destruction of Christianity, the Kabbalists have also been busy extinguishing Torah, Judaism. In his 57 book, 1957, the Zionist movement, titled The Transformation, Rabbi Israel Dom described the shattering situation of contemporary Judaism, in which 95% of the Jewish people have been removed from the way of the Torah. There's been a huge spread of heresy in an unparalleled magnitude in order to avoid any challenge of the process, or perhaps what might be called the suppression of the faith, lest the process be disturbed. Dom continued to describe the near extinction of Torah Judaism among world Jewry, a fact of which few Gentiles are aware. Some have been completely removed, others still stand on the borderline, and there are even others who, from every motive of hatred and malice, want to destroy all that their fathers had cherished. Even the small minority of those who had remained loyal to the observance of the Torah in one practice has been disturbed in its way of thought, attacked by a flood of distortion, demoralized, bewildered by errors, lies, and slanders. That's what's happening in Christianity all over, as the religions are slowly beginning to change. The very small section that remains untouched by all these tendencies is not only small but helpless. It lacks the means of publicity which are required to defend the genuine Torah point of view with clear statement widely distributed. So the result is that the Jewish reader is deprived of the opportunity of finding out how the Torah demands that he should see his place in the world, to see how he has to adhere to the rules and the laws of the Torah and his obligations. So he's also allowed to fall victim to opposing claims. This is particularly true of those of the Jews who reading is more or less confined to the English language. See, it's understandable how Kabbalistic Jews could subvert the faith of their Jewish brothers, but how is such deception on a grand scale possible? Jews who left the God of Israel and the Torah and believed in pagan worship of strange gods set about to destroy the monotheistic face of Torah Judaism, Christianity, and even Islam. These Kabbalists are guided by evil spirits and equipped with supernatural power and positions of power in the world by means of the magical arts that they are taking part in and the secret societies that they belong to infiltrate, to take control of the Gentile institutions. This modus operandi, the way they do things, is even described by an author named Edith Starr Miller. She wrote, "The obligations and rules for the right of the Jewish masses are contained in the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch, but the esoteric teachings of the higher initiates, they're to be found in the Kabbalah. Therein are contained the mysterious rites for evocations, the indications and keys to practice for conjuring up of demons, of supernatural power, forces, the science of numbers, numerology, astrology." She went on to say the practical application of the Kabbalistic knowledge is manifested in the use made of it through the ages by Jews to gain influence both in the higher spheres of Gentile lives and over the masses. Sovereigns, popes, kings and queens, popes, both usually had one or more Jews as astrologers and advisors. And they frequently gave Jews control over their life, their very life, by employing them as physicians. Political power was also gained by Jews in almost every Gentile country, alongside with financial power, since Jewish court bankers manipulated state funds and taxes. One of Donald Trump's advisors, special advisors to the president, is Jared Kushner. I just talked about it at the top of the show. History is simply repeating itself. We're back to the future. Because you want to find out what the future is, look at the past. During the Middle Ages, the infiltration, the conquest of Christianity was achieved by two methods. The Inquisition, started in Spain, 1478, forced multitudes of Jews to renounce Judaism, to embrace Catholicism. These converts were called conversos. Conversos typically went through the motions of the Roman Catholic religion, but remained Jews secretly inside and practiced their Jewish rites in the privacy of their own homes. Other Jews called Maranos, I believe that is the Spanish word for swine, feigned conversion to Christianity and practiced Roman Catholicism outwardly while practicing Judaism or Kabbalism privately. A lot of the Maranos took positions in the clergy. The motive of convert ourselves was self-preservation. And the Marranos, destruction of the church and all things Christian, the result of these parallel operations working together was the Jewish occupation of the Roman Catholic Church and its transformation into Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. The King James translation of Revelation 17 describes the Mystery Babylon the Great as the great whore and the great city which sits upon seven mountains. So you know the whole passage. The woman sitting with the scarlet beast, full of blasphemy, the seven heads, the ten horns. This woman drunk with power of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, and I wondered with great admiration, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And he saith to me, the waters which you saw, where the whore sitteth, are people, the multitudes, the nations, the tongues. And the woman which thou sawest in that great city, which reigned over the kings of the earth. So by that passage, the word mystery actually identifies this entity as a mystery religion. It's the ancient mystery Egyptian religion or the Babylonian religion. This is what I've been talking about for so long on this radio show, AVFS. I'm the Spaceman. There's more right after this on AM 640. Please send your emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Email is the only way I communicate with you. M writes, hey, Space, I'm interested in one of your topics being discussed tonight about Mormonism, Joseph Smith and his church. I was once a Mormon. I regularly attended the Mormon church for more than 20 years. Our family left the church a few years ago, maybe for reasons of controversies. A lot of her friends are very much connected to this church until now. Yes, you're right. The Mormon church has secret rituals done regularly. It's sad to say faithful members believe that through these rituals that they can attest, or they can attain, rather, the highest degree of salvation. I always look forward to listening. Signed, Em. Oh, if you look, you'll see. But if you don't look, you sit in the couch or staring at your Illuminati-controlled mass media screen. Or if you're on your smartphone, you got your face buried in that all day. Well, you'll just go on not knowing what's happening. Playing into that one law that the elite know to control masses, that down deeply, inherently, every single human being walking on the face of this earth wants to be told what to do. Because, and I'm not talking about when they know what to do. I'm talking about when all things about them are failing. They don't know which way is up anymore. And they're waiting for someone to come along to tell them what to do. So the elite rich just gladly fill that every single time, that void. So as I said before the break with the seven angels, the seven vials, talked to me saying, come hither, I will show you thee, the judgment of the great whore that sits upon the many waters. The scarlet color hair. The woman arrayed in purple. Decked with gold, precious stones, pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was named the name Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And that passage, the word mystery identifies this entity as a mystery religion. Babylon the Great. Locating the origin of this mystery religion is ancient Babylon. That great city which sits upon seven mountains pinpoints the location of the great whore in Rome, which is known historically as the city of seven hills. The only religious system that presently answers to the mystery Babylon the Great is described in Revelation, and it's the Roman Catholic Church. I believe it's actually all organized religion. Because when those words, mystery of Babylon the Great, and this Revelation 17 was written, there was no New World. There was no American Empire. You see, since the Reformation, volumes have been written about the Catholic Church, the centuries of the Inquisition with its tortures, its bloodshed, wars of conquest, and genocide. Yeah, I'm talking about a religion. Isn't that incredible? And the spreading of false doctrines and pagan traditions, sexual perversion, abuse within the clergy, not to mention the incredible wealth the Vatican has, which has extorted money, really, from its parishioners of all kinds, in all kinds of clever ways to pay for the lavish lifestyles that everyone connected with the Vatican enjoys. They live like royalty, don't they? While the millions and millions of converts around the world, many of them in abject poverty. Cue Pope Francis. Hey, I want to stay in a little shack, not spend a lot of money. All right. The scandalous deeds of the Great Whore are well-documented facts of history. That's just fact. What this show likes to deal with, not theories. Fact. What is less well understood is how the Babylonian mysteries found their way into the Church of Rome, thereby meriting God's assessment as the mystery Babylon the Great. So maybe I can point out that the real history of the Roman Catholic Church differs appreciably from the official fabrications circulated by the propaganda of the Illuminati-controlled mass media, which are under the direction of the power elite. Illuminati. As Rabbi Israel Dom once wrote, those who possess the financial means, the elites, can, through their effective disposal, almost completely predominate over everything and everybody. Their attitude, you know, I bought it, it's mine. That includes countries, peoples, businesses, land. Evidence of infiltration of the Roman Catholic Church by great masses of the European Kabbalists is found in a lot of independent sources. If you look, a plot against the Church, typical Catholic anti-Judaism, the authors culminate their ideas against Jewish infiltration of the Church, but seem blind to the fact that the Holy Catholic Church was a Judaized form of Christianity right from its inception. Because the word Judaization, Chuck pointed out at the start of the show, you have to know the meaning of, was really a Christian idea. It's the Spaceman on Talk Radio AM 640. More right after this.
Hey, it's the Spaceman on Talk Radio, AM 640 at SAVFS. Emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. So what I've been explaining tonight is crypto-Jews. That is, Jews who are not Jews but belong to secret organization have gained entrance to the highest offices of the Roman Catholic Church without being detected, and also into political and economic institutions all over the world now. First, it started with Western Europe and then America. Jewish supremacy over the Gentiles was a direct result of the Kabbalists' infiltration of the Roman Catholic Church, as well as their infiltration of the nobility of Europe, the powerful royal families of Europe. But the Catholic priests make a huge mistake when they state Holy Church every time an heretical or estranged bishop or cardinal or false pope appeared, regarded it as unavoidable to unmask them publicly in order to prevent them dragging the faithful into further misfortune. So to corroborate the Jewish infiltration of the Roman Church, the famous Jewish historian Cecil Roth, cited by Mike Pinay, and Dr. Roth was editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia Judaica, and his volume, History of the Marranos, specifically dealt with the phenomenon of crypto-Jewry in medieval Europe. You could also, I suppose, call them Kabbalists, because that's exactly what they were. In his framed work, History of the Marranos, Cecil Roth gives very interesting details on how the Jews, thanks to their equally skilled false conversion, entered Christianity and appeared publicly as Christians, but secretly held to their Kabbalist religion. He also shows how this secret belief was passed on by parents to kids, covered with the appearance of the outward Christian militancy. The church admittedly disapproved of compulsory conversion, of course. Baptisms which were undertaken under such conditions were seen as invalid. Oh, baptized against their will, so it's not on. Pope Gregory the Great, who reigned as Pope from 590 to 604 AD, repeatedly condemned them, although he did gladly receive a friendly and heartfelt way those who were attracted with other means. The greatest part of the successors followed his example. Nevertheless, heed was not always paid to the papal ban. It was naturally admitted that compulsory conversion was not mandatory. In order to circumvent that, the Jews were threatened with expulsion or even death, and they were given to understand that they would save themselves through baptism. It occurred at times that the Jews actually subjected themselves to a hard necessity. In those cases, their acceptance of Christianity was seen as spontaneous, but a compulsory mass conversion did take place in Mahorn, Majorca, in the year 418, under the protectorate of Bishop Severo. And another episode just like it took place in Clermont, Auvergne, in France, in the year 576. And in spite of the disapproval of Gregory the Great, the Pope, the example spread into different places in France. In the year 629, the Merovingian sorcerer king, King Dagobert, commanded all Jews of the land to accept baptism under threat of banishment. The same act was later repeated in Lombardy. So you see how the elite rich manipulate religion, is my point here tonight. After Jews had been driven out of the south of France, some proud ancestral families, as a result of rumors, carried on Judaism in their homes as residue of the blood of those Jews who preferred to remain as public and confessing Catholics.
Now, toward the end of the 13th century, the Anjou family, who ruled Naples, introduced a general conversion of Jews in their neighborhood of the city of Trani. Under the new name, new converts, neophytes, the proselytes continued to live for 300 years as crypto-Jews. Their secret loyalty to Judaism was one of the motives for which reason the Inquisition became a big thing in Naples in the 16th century. Some escaped to the Balkans, where they joined themselves with the existing Jewish communities there. Then their descendants in the south of Italy still preserve some vague memories of Judaism, right up to today even. But this phenomenon in no way remained restricted to the Christian world. No. Various parts of the Mohammedan world, ancient communities of Crypt Jews are found. The Dagutun of the Sahara, that tribe continued to practice Jewish belief for a long time after their formal conversion to Islam, and their present sons have still not completely forgotten it. The Donne of Seleucia originate from the adherents of the pseudo-Messiah, Sabbatai Zevi, who they followed in his rebellion. Even if they were in public, complete Muslim, they practiced at home a messianic Judaism. Now, Cecil Roth, not only omitted to inform the people that read his books of the Jewish ethnicity of the medieval power elites, or even to mention the Merovingian branch of European Jewry, the renowned Jewish historian made this astonishing statement in another work. He said it seemed that they, meaning the Jews, totally disappeared together with the breakdown of the Roman Empire. However, we don't find any evidence of their presence until the Carolingian period. Of course, we know from inscriptions and other sources about Jewish societies and single persons in all, nearly every province of the Roman Empire, and we can reasonably suppose, with or without proof, that there is in fact no district without Jews. So why would Dr. Roth attempt to conceal the real history of European Jewry from approximately 500 to 800 AD? See, he acknowledges their presence, but has nothing to say of their business, which was governing Europe. The reason will become obvious. The Merovingians, you see, the Water Kings, became the royalty of Europe, having claimed Jewish descent from King David, King Solomon, and posturing as Christians from Jesus Christ through Mary Magdalene. So starting with the first Merovingian king of France, Clovis I, who converted to Christianity in 496 AD, along with his Jewish household and 3,000 of his Jewish warriors, these Jewish monarchs were responsible for spreading an heretical version of the gospel, the Merovingian lie, which is today again being introduced to you and I through books like the Da Vinci Code, which is a revival, really, of Dr. Roth, goes like this. Mary Magdalene had been a critical figure in our story. The evidence strongly suggests she escapes Israel with the bloodline of Jesus, the heir apparent of the King of the Jews, and the issue of a royal marriage which combined the royal lines of the tribes of Judea and Benjamin, emerging as well of a patriarchal Judaism, and those Jews still honoring the mother goddess. She may have also been carrying the true royal blood, what they call the Starfire, or the Orm, as it's known to the elites, being manufactured by the Essenes for their chosen leaders. Now, Now, the Essens in those ancient times, the days of Jesus, were a group that were like our green movement today. Give us only nature's power, sunshine, wind. They were the green movement, really. So, finding her way to Gaul, where established Jewish communities already existed, the Magdalene, Mary Magdalene, found refuge for her and her treasures, the bloodline, perpetuating itself, intact, for some 400 years, including dynastic intermarriages, not only with other Jewish families, but with Romans and Visigoths as well. And here in the 5th century, Jesus' lineage became allied with the royal line of the Franks, the Germans, thereby engendering the Merovingian dynasty. This would explain the sacred status according the Merovingians. The legendary birth of Merovi, child of two fathers, one of them a symbolic marine creature from beyond the sea, a marine creature which, like Jesus, might be equated with a mystical fish. Merovi, one of the fisher kings. Another Jewish historian, Harold Graetz, recorded in history of the Jews a similar forced conversion by Clovis, another Merovingian. His father-in-law, Chilperic, who lived from 523-584 AD, who ruled over Burgundy of the Frankish kingdom. Germans in those days. Although King Chilperic wasn't very favorable to the Catholic clergy, he also forced the Jews in his kingdom to be baptized, and he personally went to the baptismal font as pater of the newly converted. But he was satisfied with the mere appearance of conversions and wasn't really hostile to the Jews when they continued to celebrate the Sabbath and followed the Jewish law instead. As long as he controls them, the Merovingian king's thinking, Clovis. It's a spaceman. Talk radio, AM 640. This is AVFS. More right after this. It's a spaceman on talk radio, AM 640. It's a view from space. I communicate by email only, spaceman@640toronto.com. One address, the other, space@640toronto.com. Thank you so much for the one that you've sent. I really appreciate it. What I'm speaking about tonight is the rich using religion to control the masses. A lot of people look at religion and don't see the elite rich behind it, but they are there. It's the best way to control great amounts of people. And they're always the elites and the Merovingian bloodline are the ones that have been in control. King Dagobert I, the great-great-grandson of Clovis I, the first ever of the Merovingian Fisher King's dynasty, followed in his ancestors' footsteps by forcing conversions of Jews, as recorded by the Jewish historian Roth. Forcing Jews to convert, Dagobert set a precedent for future contravention of a ban of Gregory the Great, who was himself a Merovingian, and as Pope, politically, publicly, condemning the forced conversion of Jews, but failed to enforce the papal ban. The Church admittedly disapproved of compulsory conversion also. Pope Gregory the Great, as I said, repeatedly condemned them. Nevertheless, not a lot of attention was paid to the papal ban. In order to circumvent it, the Jews were threatened with expulsion or death, and they were given to understand that they would save themselves through baptism. Now, in the year 629, King Dagobert commanded all Jews of the land to accept baptism under the threat of banishment, this time putting his foot down. Toward the end of the 13th century, the Anjou, who ruled Naples, the family, introduced a general conversion of Jews. A lot of them asserted that they were descended from the aristocracy of Jerusalem and had been deported by Titus or by earlier conquerors into banishment. So the irony of this charade really is, of the elite controlling religions, is that popes who condemned forced conversions to Christianity, like Gregory I and the rulers who compelled the Jews to convert, such as Dagobert in the House of Anjou, were all Merovingian Kabbalists. The foreseeable consequence of coercing a whole population of Jews to convert to Maranos. Maranos Christianity, it was called. It was a massive infiltration of the Roman Catholic Church by European Kabbalists. It was from the Catholic expose of the Merovingians, titled The Merovingian Infiltration of the Christian World Through Monasticism, that you find Pope Gregory the Great, who actually put out the phony papal ban against compulsory conversions, was also a Merovingian. September 3rd, that date became a day of victory for the Red Movement when he was installed as their pope. Gregory marked the history of the papacy in that it was the very first monk, he was the very first monk to become pope. Accordingly, when Phocas, a cruel military usurper, murdered Emperor Maurice and his entire family in the most brutal way, Gregory sent a letter to Phocas, the murderer, expressing hopes that peace was now restored. A letter which criticized him while he lived. Another criticism was his wasting of the entire treasury of the church. Butler's comment was that Mary Magdalene's story was received in the West following Pope Gregory the Great now makes sense, since she is the center of all for the Merovingian heresy. Which is that Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ had children who became the great royal houses of all of Europe. It was Pope Gregory the Great who confused Mary Magdalene and Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus, into one person. In 591 AD, Gregory actually declared in a sermon, "She, whom Luke calls the sinful woman, whom John calls Mary of Bethany, we believe to be the Mary from whom seven devils were ejected, according to Mark." This then becomes the official teaching of the Catholic Church, that this Mary was also the prostitute who washed the feet of Jesus in Luke 7, verses 36 through 50, merging the identities of the women who followed Jesus provided the theological support for the Merovingian fabrication of the legendary wife of Jesus. The Jewish historian Roth, who would have the world believe that the medieval Kabbalists were quietly minding their own business from 500 to 800 AD, while in fact they were actually managing the affairs of state for the thrones of the head royalty of Europe and the papacy. Michael Bradley wrote of their acquired nobility and the Holy Grail across the Atlantic. He wrote this: "There was a very great Jewish component among the Sicambrian Franks, the Germans, the Merovingians, and that they had practiced polygamy," another Merovingian peculiarity, by the way, "because they're sun worshippers. They left many offspring. These aristocratic Merovingian children married into almost all of the noble families of Europe through the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries. This has prompted more than one historian to suggest that the foundation of the European nobility itself is all believers in the Kabbalistic way of life, Enoch's black magic."
And that's what I've been saying. Spaceman, it's Talk Radio, AM 640. It's more of what I'm saying. Next. Emails to spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. It's the only way I communicate, and I thank you for the one that you've sent me. So, there's this. It was in 679 AD, the Carolingians, a rival dynasty to the Merovingians, arranged for the assassination of the Merovingian king, Dagobert II, grandson of Dagobert I, and his son Sisebert IV. Kill them both off. The Merovingians, though, claim that documents discovered in France testify to the continuation of that Merovingian lineage in the person of Sigismund, who, they happily report, survived the assassination attempt, like Neymar, bringing in the tribe of Cain seed from after the flood. The Merovingian dynasty continued formerly with Thierry IV and Childeric III, who was removed in 751, and this was the end of the dynasty, according to the parchment found by Saunier at Rennes-le-Château, and this could be true according to some historians. Sigismund IV escaped and arrived in the Rays on the 17th of January, 681, where he took refuge with his grandfather. Dagobert II had a second wife, Giselle, the daughter of Vera II, the Count of Rays. The Merovingian line included, after Sigismund IV, also known as the Plantard, from whom Mr. Plantard took his name, Sigismund V, Vera III, Guillemont, Vera IV, Vera V, Childeric I, and finally Sisebert VI, known as Ursus. I got all of that Merovingian lineage, by the way, from the official International Knights Templar website. Now, the Knights Templar were the ones that were commissioned to keep the bloodline of the Merovingian secret and intact on who the latest one was, the most purest. But that website, by the way, no longer available. Now, in 750 AD, a document titled The Donation of Constantine was discovered, which proclaimed that the Pope was Christ's elected representative on earth with the power to create kings as his subordinates. Keep in mind that the Merovingians now controlled the papacy. Now, in 751, the provisions of this document, supposedly signed by Constantine, were put into effect by the Vatican, and the Pope gave permission to Pepin III, the mayor of the palace of Austrasia, to take the Frankish crown from Dagobert's nephew, Childeric III. Pepin became the first Carolingian king of the Franks, the Germans then, and was succeeded in 768 by his sons Carloman and Charles I, who was later called Charlemagne. The Merovingian dynasty was terminated in 800 AD, supposedly with the papal coronation of Charlemagne, who became the Holy Roman Emperor. Now, Charlemagne became the Holy Roman Emperor in 800 AD. And that would appear to be the coup d'etat, removing the Merovingians from power for good. But, according to Margaret Starbird, author of The Woman with the Alabaster Jar, Mary Magdalene and the Holy Grail, to consolidate his claim to the throne of the Franks, Charlemagne had himself married a Merovingian princess. And
shows that the stranglehold that the Merovingian Kabbalists had on Europe, that Charlemagne and his Carolingian successors married Merovingian wives to guarantee the continuation of their dynasty. Notice it's the female side of the family that marries to keep the Merovingian bloodline. That's why we're pushing women now. Because the Merovingians are in Buckingham Palace. The Merovingian infiltration of the Christian world through monasticism also mentions that the Carolingians not only took steps to legitimize themselves as Holy Roman Emperors by taking Merovingian wives, but also claiming descent from Jesus Christ. Now in the 8th century, the Merovingian dynasty of France was overthrown by the mayors of the Merovingian palaces, the Carolingians. But Carolingians were also a major part of the Jesus Magdalene lie. They took Merovingian wives to assure that the heretical divine bloodline was preserved twofold. The Carolingian Empire became the unholy Roman Empire under the Charlemagne dynasty, who became the first emperor. That was a huge coup. Dagobert's Revenge is the magazine of the Ordo Lapsit Exilis, which is dedicated to the restoration of the Merovingian dynasty, by the way, for the world government, the one world government. It's in business today. And the title Dagobert's Revenge signifies not just the vengeance sought by the Merovingians against the Catholic Church, which betrayed them. And you can see that today. It would be the Anglican Church, actually. The British warring against the Roman Catholic Church. But also the struggle of all the members of the ancient bloodline of the Holy Grail, which goes back, they believe, to the beginnings of civilization, the only bearers of true God-ordained sovereignty against the forces which in every age have attempted to wrest power away from the bloodline merely for the purpose of domination. The OLE, as they call it, the Ordo Lapsit Exilis, claims to be an invisible group of men. That secret organization I opened the show with, dedicated to the recovery of what do you think? They're dedicated to the recovery of the stone that fell from heaven, called out by our ancestors, the Grail. The Ordo Lapsit Exilis secret organization. Explanation of the Grail should give you a clue as to the true origins of the Merovingians and who they were. Here's that excerpt. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will exalt my throne above all stars of God, I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High. Isaiah 14, verses through 12 through 14. It's totally obvious that the Jesus Mary Magdalene lie is a deception of enormous magnitude for Merovingian claims to divinity. And they point to lineage from another source altogether. The progenitors of the ancient bloodline of the Holy Grail, which goes back to the beginning of civilization, were the fallen angels who mated with women. As I told you earlier, the son of Satan and Eve was Cain. The fallen fallen angels who mated with human women, as stated in Genesis 6, 1 and 2. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives, of all which they chose. Remember, the Illuminati are going to follow the King James Version of the Bible to the letter. So according to a Hebrew resource for navigating the Bible, the sons of God were the Titans, the Nephilim in Hebrew, literally fallen ones. They were called this because they were the sons of the fallen angels, as Yonathan, Targum, the demonic names. This demonic ancestry of the Merovingians is explicitly stated on Dagobert's Revenge in Edward de Legionnaire's essay, The Biological Basis of Elitism and Divine Right to Rule. The all-important element of the divine right to rule is that it comes from God, or the gods. And who were these gods? Well, authors like Zachariah Sitchin, the late Sir Lawrence Gardner, Nicholas de Vere, are authoritatively convinced that kingship was created by an advanced race of beings called the Anunnaki, also called the Nephilim in the Old Testament. These were the ones who created the human race, we're told, and interbred with a portion of it to create the kingly caste, which until this day have still maintained control over the earth. The Illuminati, the half-god, half-man. These celestial creatures have been variously identified with dragons, elves, fairies, gnomes, leprechauns, nymphs, sprites, pixies, angels, devils, witches, demons, giants, vampires, werewolves. Just about every mythical being you can imagine. Some like Lawrence Gardner, now deceased, and Zachariah Sitchin, claim that they come from another planet. Others like Nicholas de Vere say that they're multidimensional, or that they're from the hollow earth, living inside and underneath our earth. According to the Book of Enoch, the Kabbalah, the prophet as translated by Richard Lawrence, the Nephilim are actually descended and described as descended from Mount Hermon. Here's his words. And the angels, the children of heaven, saw them, handsome and beautiful daughters, and desired them. And they were altogether 200, and they descended into Ardos, which is the summit of Mount Hermon, and they called the Mount Armon, for they swore and bound one another by a curse. That's the Book of Enoch. Won't be in your King James Version, Revelation, or Genesis, or anywhere. It's Enoch, Book of Enoch. As recorded in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the days of Jared, 200 watchers descended on Ardis, the summit of Mount Hermon, a mythical location supposedly equated with the triple peak of Jebel Esh Sheikh, which is 9,200 feet, a hidden 11, placed in the most northerly region of ancient Palestine. The Dead Sea Scrolls, by the way, include the earliest version of the Book of Enoch, which was rejected by the Council of Nicaea, of the Vatican, when they were putting together what was to go in the today's version of the King James Version of the Bible. It wasn't included. The scrolls were authored by the monastic Asen community of Qumran, believed to be the tribe of Dan, which brought back the pre-flood paganism, Baal worship of the Canaanites. The location of Nephilim's descent? Mount Hermon, also called Mount Sion. It's in the territory of, where else? Dan, formerly the land of the Canaanites in northern Israel. According to the Atlas of the Bible Lands, part of the tribe of Dan, unable to secure its inheritance, migrated north and captured Laish, renaming it Dan. It's the Spaceman on Talk Radio, AM 640. I've got to call space. It's a view from space on Talk Radio, AM 640. It's all it is. Emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Now, I told you about children of heaven, the angels, come down from another world, landed on Mount Hermon, the summit of Mount Hermon. Well, it just so happens that the northern area of Palestine where Mount Hermon is located just happens to be that area that's very disputed today. And it is located at exactly 33 degrees of latitude and longitude. According to the Paris Zoo Meridian, which was used before the Greenwich International Zero Meridian was established in 1884. So Saint-Sulpice, who died in 647, a contemporary of Saint Dagobert, was also holding a feast day on January 17th. He was the second bishop of Bourges, which is on the zero meridian of Paris, like Rennes Levin, was successful in converting all of the Jews of his diocese. He was the protege of the goldsmith of Saint-Eloi, the grand vizier of Dagobert I, the Merovingian king. The very famous seminary and church dedicated to him in Paris contains actually the obelisk with the copper line down the center marking the exact point of the meridian. Saint-Sulpice, to the grounds of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, had connections with the Priory of Sion from its very foundation in 1642. Now, monasticism, monasteries, they were often fronts for the occult as well as homosexual activity, as you might well be aware, especially if you're a listener to this radio show, AVFS on Talk Radio, AM 640. The Merovingian infiltration of the Christian world through monasticism confirms the suspicion that many Catholic religion communities were steeped in Gnostic occultism, and that these Gnostic cults were points of entry for the Merovingians' bloodline to be party to the papacy. St. Gregory the Great was the first of the 50 Benedictine monks who would become pope. The Merovingian Franks ruled from 450 to 741, built monasteries as a means of infiltration. Merovingians' monasteries wrote your history that you read today, later became Benedictine Cistercian. Pope Gregory the Great promoted Benedictine monasticism. His feast day is the day he became pope, September 3rd, 590 AD. This was accomplished by the infiltration of the church, and Gregory was part of that infiltration. September 3rd became a day of victory, as a matter of fact, for the Red Movement when he was installed as their pope. For Gregory marks the history of the papacy in that he was the very first monk ever, all time, to become pope. The origins of monasticism began in, are you ready, Egypt. Hermes Trismegistus, the Greek Neoplatonist, named for the Egyptian god Thoth, who was the founder of alchemy, geometry, and the prototype of the hermit. You know, that one that lives alone and is rarely ever seen. And the philosophy of Plato and Neoplatonists, spiritually increased and earthly values were demonized. The famous Egyptian hermit Saint Anthony the Great was the founder of the Eastern monasticism and mystery religious schools, as well as the most influential figure in the development of pre-Benedictine monasticism. In the 4th century, monasticism was taken and established in Europe by Saint Athanasius, the Bishop of Alexandria, who was deeply influenced by Saint Anthony. Now, Anthony of Egypt is the strict self-denial practicing brother of the sun god and founder of Eastern monasticism. Demons permeate his legend. He passed one of his sheepskin cloaks to Athanasius, the spiritual head of desert hermits in Ethiopia, Bishop of Alexandria and father of orthodoxy. Athanasius had likewise given his cloak, passed on his duties, to Anthony, and later wrote Anthony's biography, just as Gregory later wrote Benedict's. Anthony's feast day, January 17th, would become sacred to the Merovingians and their Priory of Sion organization, which members gathered together to celebrate every January 17th in honor of Anthony's success at infiltrating the Christian world. Anthony's body, you see, would be buried in Vienne, France. It was Athanasius, who introduced monasticism to the Romans and introduced monasteries and the monastery way of life to Germans. The rule of Saint Columbanus and of Benedict in Europe were developed into major monastic communities by the Merovingians, who provided not only the monasteries themselves, but charters granting them complete exemption from church and government intervention, making them fully and completely autonomous. Go your own way. Make your own rules. So Merovingians of ancient Egypt had ensured the continuity and the continuation of that Egyptian era. Gibbons hits the nail on the head when he wrote, "Swarms of monks arose from the Nile, overspread and darkened the Christian world." It's from his book called Saints Who History Made. Athanasius is also known as the father of orthodoxy, by the way, and the theological center of the Nicene Age. As the famous opponent of the Arian heresy, it was Athanasius who valiantly defended the divinity of Jesus Christ, but he also taught that the incarnation of the world and the word divinized human flesh, making it possible for men to become God. Divinized. God became man that men might become gods, wrote Athanasius. Arianism was condemned, and Arius, who was a Jew, was excommunicated at the Council of Nicaea in 321 AD. Although Athanasius led the bishops to contend for the faith as to the person of Jesus Christ, it was this ecumenical council that celibacy became a requirement for Roman Catholic leaders, as stated in the Roman Catholic Encyclopedia. And other traditions of the Roman Catholic Church were adopted too from Egyptian monasteries under the leadership of one Athanasius that I'm telling you about tonight. The rich, the elites, they control religions, set them up, take them down. Xavier FS and Talk Radio AM 640.
This is View from Space on Talk Radio AM 640. Communicate by email only. You know that. space@640toronto.com or spaceman@640toronto.com. Hey, thanks for yours. So, as I said before, Athanasius is the key to all of this. The father of orthodoxy. Yeah. And Athanasius was the man who led the bishops to contend for the faith as to the person of Jesus Christ. It was at his ecumenical council that celibacy became a requirement for Roman Catholic leaders, which gives you the homosexuality angle. It was Athanasius from Egypt. The Egyptian mystery religion infiltrating this thing called Christianity. For instance, here's some other things adopted from Egyptian monasticism under the leadership of Athanasius. Virgins were now seen as exclusively as the bride of Christ. Another one, the deification of virgins led to the Blessed Virgin Mary. Virgin Mary became the model for virgins. Convents began to be established. The vow of silence is now introduced because of Athanasius and his ideas from the Egyptian monastic scene that they had going there. Pilgrimages to the Holy Land, venerated sacred sites and mystical caves. Inheritances are given to the Roman Catholic Church after deaths in families. If you can imagine. Well, your father is dead now, and all of his legacy goes to the Roman Catholic Church. Wow. Athanasius. An Egyptian monastic powerhouse. I say the elite rich control the religions. Here's another one. That under his leadership were adopted by the Roman Catholic Church. Pilgrimages to the Holy Land. Oh, I said that. Bishops, priests, earthly representatives of virgins, heavenly bridegroom. And monks were now appointed, or could be appointed as bishops. See, it's conceivable that the Council of Nicaea, later ecumenical councils, and the controversies leading to them were part of the dialectical process to remove Christianity from its scriptural original base and to introduce a lie, to challenge a biblical truth, and stage an ecumenical council to bring in another lie. The Nestorian controversy revolved around the question of whether Mary was the mother of God or the mother of Christ, as stated by Nestorius. At the Council of Ephesus in 431 AD, Nestorius was condemned and Mary was declared to be the mother of God. By the way, you may not be aware of this, but Ephesus was the center of goddess worship, where the Essens established their school for the Illuminati. The first known Illuminati order, Ulumbrado, was founded 1492, the same year Columbus sailed the ocean blue, by Spanish Kabbalists called Marranos, mentioned earlier in the show, who were also known as the Crypto-Jews, with violent persecution in Spain and Portugal beginning in 1391 by these guys. Hundreds of thousands of Jews had to be forced to convert to the faith of the Roman Catholic Church or die. Publicly, they were now Roman Catholics, as they wanted to save their life, but secretly they practiced the Kabbalah. The Marranos
were able to teach their children secretly. After 1540, the year 1540, many Marranos opted to flee to England, also to Holland, also to France, the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, Brazil, and other places in South and Central America. The Marranos kept strong family ties, and they became very wealthy, very influential in the nations where they lived. But as is the custom with all Jewish people, it did not matter in what nation they lived. Their loyalty was to themselves and Judaism, how the world government rules nations. In 1492, Spanish Roman Catholics also expelled the last of the Muslims and Jews from Spain. The Roman Catholics expelled the last of the Muslims and Jews from Spain, 1492. Pretty big year in Spain, wasn't it, for discovering the New World with Columbus? The reason for the Spanish Inquisition is buried under a mile-high pile of propaganda, believe me. And the anti-Semitism of that church. From 1000 to 1200 AD, the magical, mystical system known as the Kabbalah was developed mainly by Sephardi, African Jews, especially in Spain. The Inquisition was not directed against the Jews for practicing Torah or Judaism, no, but for criminal and tantric sex magic. Because the Talmud directs Jews to exterminate Christians and the Kabbalah contains erotic elements. Also in 1492, Christopher Columbus's, I mentioned earlier, was funded by the Kabbalists to explore the New World in search of a homeland for their persecuted brethren. On August 2nd, the Druid Feast of Lunasa, in 1492, Columbus set sail for the New World, sponsored by Leonardo da Vinci, Grand Master of the Priory of Sion in those years, and funded by wealthy Merovingian families like the Medicis of Italy, according to Occult Conspiracy by Michael Howard, who wrote, Columbus was associated with a political group that supported the ideas of Dante, one of the alleged Grand Masters of the Order of the Rosy Cross, who is known to have used codes, ciphers in his writings, a practice associated with membership of a secret society. Columbus' voyages of discovery were sponsored by Leonardo da Vinci and Lorenzo de' Medici, both initiates of secret societies. I know for a fact that Leonardo da Vinci was a Freemason and a Kabbalist. And Lorenzo de' Medici, well, that family, the de' Medicis, oh my, the de' Medici gave many kings and queens to Italy, and many popes, too. That one family, the elite rich, controlling all, religion and politics in those times. And there's also speculation, you know, that Leonardo da Vinci was of Jewish extraction. The nobility of a talented bastard, Leonardo, such as the caption of an article of the important Italian newspaper at the time, Corriere della Sera, of October 1st, 2000. Yeah, just almost 20 years ago now. Recent research maintains the article begins that the Maestro da Vinci was born of a Jewess who stemmed from Russia. Yeah, well, all I know is Leonardo da Vinci is the great artist he is today because of the secrets that are clearly displayed in his paintings. Likewise, there's an evidence that Christopher Columbus was a Kabbalist. The Jewish scholar Elazar Zekel cites Columbus's biographer de Magarania of Spain, and the Jewish historian Cecil Roth as providing the most compelling arguments for this. There's been some weighty scholarly debate over the possibility that Christopher Columbus, though undeniably a devout and zealous Catholic, might also have been the proud descendant of Spanish Kabbalists. Ironically, this view has been championed by some patriotic Spaniards who would rather have him a Spanish Jew than an Italian Gentile. So there's evidence that Columbus actually spoke Spanish while still living in Italy, and an unusual situation unless his family had originated in Spain, wouldn't you think? There were many Spanish-speaking Jewish refugees from the Inquisition and the Genoa area. The name Colon, which Columbus adopted as the Spanish equivalent of his last name, was not the expected form, which would have been Colom or Colombo. It was a very common Jewish variation on that name. Columbus was known to frequent the company of Jews and former Jews, among whom were some very famous astronomers, some famous navigators, as well as his official translator. Maranos figure prominently among Columbus's backers and crew. Throughout his life, he demonstrated a very keen knowledge of the Bible and the geography of the Holy Land. In fact, in one place, he calculated the date from the destruction of the second house, the Temple of Solomon, counting from the traditional and erroneous Jewish date of 68 CE, rather than the generally accepted 70 AD. It's the Spaceman. This is Talk Radio, AM 640. More on the other side. I got a little carried away reading emails, sir. This is Spaceman Talk Radio, AM 640. This is A View from Space. By the way, my email addresses are space@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. I say most of them are very compelling. They'll suck me right in. I thank you for the one that you sucked me in with. So, as I said before the break, Columbus was known to frequent the company of Jews and former Jews, among whom were some very noted people, astronomers, navigators. And also, besides Leonardo da Vinci and Christopher Columbus and the Medici family, there were other financiers for Columbus and his trip to find the New World. It came from the House of Anjou, another Jewish family, by the way, and specifically from René d'Anjou of Languedoc in France, who was the Grand Master of the Priory of Sion from 1418 to 1840. That's the group that looks after the lineage, the purest of the bloodline, coming from the line of Cain, who will give us the Antichrist. René d'Anjou sought to promote the advancement of learning, and at one time employed Christopher Columbus. And René was, although his Angevin ancestry, one of Christ's most prominent living descendants, when René and Isabel became the Duke and Duchess of Lorraine, court was held at their castles throughout Anjou and Provence. These courts included Jewish Kabbalists, astrologers, and even the physician Jean de Saint-Rémy, grandfather of Nostradamus. In fact, Christopher Columbus was a member of the court for a while, and René was the person who gave him his first ship's commission to Tunis and Tunisia. To the present day, Saint-René d'Anjou is venerated as one of the many phallic saints of France. As a matter of fact, the website that publishes sacred texts on sacred sexuality provides the abominable details of the worship of Priapus, who was the first bishop of Lyon in the south part of France, Provence-Languedoc, and Lyonnais. Now, Priapus was worshipped under the title of Saint Foutin. Little name changed there to hide the demonology. Similar phallic saints were worshipped under the names of Saint Gerlercon or Gerlerchon and Bourdieu in the Diocese of Bourges, of Saint Gilles in Cotentin of Brittany, and also of Saint René in Anjou, and of Saint Renaud in Burgundy, and Saint Arnaud, and above all, Saint Guinol near Brest, at the village of La Châtelet in Berry. And many of these are still in existence in their worship, in full practice, right up until this recent last century. It seems that the Jews saw America as the new Jerusalem. Columbus believed when he landed in America that God had led him to the new Jerusalem also. The idea of America as the fulfillment of a biblical prophecy concerning the foundation of a spiritual utopia on earth was a central belief in the Rosicrucian philosophy of the 17th century. These little-known facts of history actually explain why the Great Seal of the United States is a highly symbolic representation of America's designated role as the new Jewish homeland, with the original 13 colonies representing the 13 tribes of Israel. The highest incidence of 13s in the Great Seal is detailed in any of the documents that you read that will show you the real secret destiny of America, the significance of the mystical 13, which frequently appears on the Great Seal of the United States, is not limited to the number of the original colonies of 13, the sacred emblem of the ancient initiates. It's composed of 13 stars. Also appears above the head of the eagle, the motto, E Pluribus Unum, containing 13 letters, as does the inscription, Anuit Coptus. The eagle clutches in his right talon a branch which has 13 leaves, 13 berries, and in its left, a sheaf of 13 arrows. The face of the pyramid, exclusively of the panel containing the date, consists of 72 stones, arranged in 13 rows. And you don't think any of that's coincidence. In British Israelism, which is Judeo-Masonic doctrine, the number 13 symbolizes the 13 tribes of Israel in accordance with the blessing of Jacob, Israel, upon his sons in Genesis 49. It's the Spaceman on Talk Radio, AM 640. Direct your emails to spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. Thanks for yours. Jay writes from Mississippi. I see that Trump is bending to the will of the Jews. Will that not piss off the Germans, the true leaders? How does this make sense? It's quite easy. I just want to refer to you again with my line. The chaos candidate became the disruptive president. He's going to disrupt things, make a lot of people mad. Now I refer to your email line. Will that not piss off the Germans? Yeah. That's what it's supposed to do. Things are working according to plan. The disruptive president is unleashed.
one more. This from J&S. Middle-aged couple listening from the distant land of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Your show has been one on point tonight. We appreciate what you bring to the table. Please don't let others get you down. Keep up the great work. Well, I did get a ensconced in one of my lengthy emails about how I was actually an Illuminati member, and I was actually just telling all the people what they wanted to hear. Never did that in my life, never will. In British Israelism, which is Judeo-Masonic doctrine, the number 13 symbolizes the 13 tribes of Israel in accordance with the blessing of Jacob. Did you know that? That's Jacob's blessing upon his sons in Genesis 49. You'll find that, King James Version of the Bible. British Israelites teacher Gene Scott explained, "It must be remembered that Manasseh is the 13th tribe. Ephraim moved into Joseph's place, and Manasseh was added to the 12. What's more, Scott claims that the tribe of Manasseh founded the United States. When the number of colonies, lost tribes, reached 13, the colonists declared independence from Great Britain as the 13 United States of America. The United States being founded as a permanent home by the pilgrims of the tribe of Manasseh." That should show you the emblems of that tribe be reflected. And it is. It'll be found in that great seal of the United States that contains 10 features of 13. And given that some 16 drafts over a period of 159 years throughout which the seal was constructed, it makes sense. Coincidence impossible, too, as an explanation for those 13s. I know that the easy answer to the fact of all these 13s is that there were 13 original colonies. But this surface explanation doesn't fit all the evidence. When the facts of the United States and the Great Seal are viewed in context of the whole Lost Tribes teaching, it obviously fits like it belonged. The coincidence of there being 13 colonies doesn't add a whit to the total picture unless it's taken to be part of the Lost Tribes material. If Christopher Columbus discovered America, why was the continent not named Columbia? Or a similar name like Columba? The official legend is that America was named after an Italian voyager, Amerigo Vespucci, which makes very little sense. It'll come as a revelation to many North Americans that the name America probably came from Ameru. That word. Ameru? Oh, the serpent god of South America. Ameru. Also known as Quetzalcoatl to the Aztecs. And Aviracoca to the people of Central Andes. All sun-worshipping cults. Interesting, too, the Book of Mormon claims that Jesus appeared as the god Quetzalcoatl in South America, the New World. But the Roman Catholic Church's conquistadors tried to obliterate all the signs of the truth of Jesus Quetzalcoatl in the New World by burning the codices, the written word, but they did not destroy them all. Oh, neophyte left the land shortly after Jesus appeared to the Aztecs as the god Quetzalcoatl. Upon his arrival in Egypt, he took the name Alexander, Helios, and set his Leohonis needles for the land of the Israelites. He was granted honorary membership of the Essenes of the Qumran community. And at Qumran, Helios performed a most important job. He became the chief archivist of the Qumran community. It was he
who dutifully removed all scriptural references to the Golden Plates, the Book of the Mormons, from the Dead Sea Scrolls before they were buried. This explains why no references to Mormonism occur in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in any books of the Holy Bible. This sensitive work was done on commandment from Jesus and the presence of the angel Moroni, who appeared to Alexander in 44 AD. Moroni reveals to Alexander that the knowledge of the records of Lemon is yet not to be revealed. The Holy Scrolls of Qumran contain writings that cannot be revealed to the world, but it is to be had and kept in the Holy Temple of God until the full ripeness of time. The religions have more surprises. Quetzalcoatl, Ameru, Viracocha, corresponds to the Egyptian god Osiris, you know, who ruled over the first time, when life was first conceived. Hans Jonas wrote in the Gnostic religion that Osiris had the ability to walk on the oceans and traveled around the globe, bringing civilization to many nations. Osiris corresponds to the Babylonian Tammuz myth, who was Nimrod of Genesis 11. This pagan deity was worshipped in the wilderness by Israelites who broke away from God of Israel as Chiun, the Assyrian-Babylonian god of the planet Saturn, and as Tammuz before their removal to Babylon. That's recorded even in Ezekiel 8, verse 14 of the King James Version of the Bible. A statue of the Assyrian-Babylonian god of the planet Saturn was actually used to symbolize Israelite apostasy. The god Saturn is represented by the misnamed Star of David, the six-pointed star that it's been the symbol of apostate Kabbalistic Judaism from antiquity to the present time. It was Solomon's seal, actually, the six-pointed star, which is now the flag of Israel. On the Great Seal of the United States, there also appears a six-pointed star. Modern false teachers with Judeo-Masonic leanings tell the tale of an American Jew who merited the honor of having the symbol of apostate Kabbalistic Judaism inscribed on the Great Seal of the United States. Chaim Solomon's largesse turned the rag-tag outfit of 33rd-degree Freemason George Washington into the professional army that won the Revolutionary War. America has been blessed by the Jewish community. Let there be no mistake. Let me take you back to a story of the American Revolution and Chaim Solomon, a Philadelphia banker, when George Washington and the Continental Army were still fighting for their very lives in the snows of Valley Forge. They didn't have enough food to eat. They didn't have enough weapons. They didn't have enough ammunition to keep fighting Britain. And it looked like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness would, well, never happen. Chaim Solomon went to the Jewish people of America and the Jewish people of Europe and raised millions of dollars and gave it to George Washington. That contribution turned the tide of the American Revolution, we're told. George Washington was so appreciative of Chaim Solomon's contribution that he had the engravers of the American $1 bill express his appreciation to the Jewish people by placing this insignia over the head of the American eagle. It is the Mogan David, the Star of David. In addition, around the Mogan David is the cloudburst of the Shekinah glory of God, which was over the tabernacle. If you turn it upside down, then the menorah magically appears. The contribution the Jewish people made to assist America in the war effort was one that George Washington insisted that all Americans know about. I wonder if anybody listening in America to me right now knew about it. Now, in 1771, along this history of the elite rich manipulating religions, John Carroll, a Jesuit priest from a wealthy Maryland family, became a professional father of the Society of Jesus and a professor at Bourges in France. In 1781, Friar Carroll, John Carroll, founded the Sulpiolan Seminary in Baltimore, Maryland. And in 1789, the year the United States Constitution took effect, founded Georgetown University. And what is that? Well, of course, it's a Jesuit university, Jesuit institution that was managed by the Sulpician order for a period of time. The Sulpicians are a heretical Catholic order whose headquarters are located on the Zero Meridian in Paris, France. And what's interesting is Saint-Sulpice, like his contemporary King Dagobert, a Merovingian, converted the Jews of his diocese en masse to Christianity. Saint-Sulpice, the contemporary of Saint Dagobert, also has his feast day on January 17th. He was the second bishop of Bourges, which is on the Zero Meridian of Paris, like Rennes-les-Bains, and was successful in converting all of the Jews of his diocese. He was the protege of the goldsmith of Saint Eloi, Grand Vizier of Dagobert I. The famous seminary and church dedicated to him in Paris contains the obelisk, as a matter of fact, with the copper line I told you about earlier down the center, marking the exact point of the 33rd meridian. Remember, the zero meridian is now the 33rd degree longitude. The significance of this meridian in the lost tribes of Dan and territories of Dan in the land of Israel is huge. In 1790, John Carroll was appointed by the Roman Catholic Church to be the first bishop to the United States with the task of organizing the Catholic Church to this new nation. Bishop Carroll encouraged Catholic religious orders to establish branches in the U.S., and with the help of George Washington, the Freemason, secured federal funds even to send Catholic missionaries to the Western Territories. John Carroll becomes the Archbishop in 1808, and under his leadership, the Catholic population in the United States increases from 25,000 to 200,000. John Carroll had a brother, Daniel. I'll tell you about him next on Talk Radio, AM 640. Just got a little bit to do with the Constitution of America. This is A View from Space on Talk Radio, AM 640. I'm Space. I'm your guy to call Space. It's A View from Space, Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails to spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. You can imagine talking about religion tonight and the manipulation of it, because, you see, there was a religion that was pretty close to the truth at the very beginning, but then through time, it's sort of like that story that they tell about school where, you know, you just get into school and they show you how rumors can actually start to morph and take on a life of their own. So you're asked to whisper something very quickly into your neighbor's ear, and they turn around and whisper what they think they heard to the next neighbor's ear, and on and on down the rows of the schoolroom class it goes. So the very first person gets up and states what was actually said at the very beginning. And then the person at the end says what they thought they heard after going through about 25 or 30 people. And it is just so astronomically different. You'd never even think that it originated where? This is where religion has gone. John Carroll, the Jesuit priest, wealthy Maryland family. The elite rich manipulate religion. Had a brother, Daniel Carroll, was a framer, a signer of the Constitution of America, and a Freemason who participated in laying the Masonic cornerstone in the United States U.S. Capitol. The Catholic Encyclopedia entry for Daniel states, initially he was prevented from becoming involved in Maryland politics by laws that included Catholics from, banned Catholics rather, from holding public office. Once these laws were repealed in 1776, beginning of the country, he was elected the upper house of Maryland legislature in 1777. The very next year, he got the job. He was a delegate from Maryland to the Continental Congress and was one of the signers of the Articles of Confederation. The Carroll brothers, you see, were cousins of one Charles Carroll, also a high-ranking Freemason, as well as the only Roman Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence, by the way. All the Carrolls, who were colleagues of President George Washington, were educated at Jesuit institutions, Jesuit school at Bohemia, on Harmon's Manor in Maryland, and the Jesuits College in St. Omer in French Flanders. Charles went on to other Jesuit institutions of higher learning, also the College of the Jesuits at Rheims, and then the College Louis de Grand at Paris. According to a Catholic expose of Masonic infiltration of the Roman Catholic Church, in the United States, founded as it was upon Masonic principles, infiltration is hardly the appropriate word. Charles Carroll, a very high-ranking Freemason and relative of the United States of America's first bishop, had been the only Catholic to sign the Declaration of Independence. And by 1895, Archbishop Ireland could tell the French, I believe that a divine mission had been assigned to the Republic of the United States, that mission to prepare the world by example, moral influence, for the universal reign of human liberty and the rights of man. How is it that the Vatican, which had an official policy that forbade Roman Catholics under the threat of excommunication from holding membership in Masonic orders, and regularly issued papal bulls against Freemasonry, how is it that Pope Pius the sixth appointed the Jewish priest John Carroll, the guy I was just talking about, whose family was deeply involved in Freemasonry at the highest levels, as the first bishop of the United States, with the charge of founding colleges, of establishing a Catholic hierarchy, and generally organizing the Catholic Church in the new nation? Well, the answer can be found in the origins of the Jesuits. In fact, the classical land of crypto-Jewry is Spain. Tradition there has been durable and universal to such an extent that a person must raise the suspicion that a Marianian receptivity is present in the atmosphere of the land itself. Even at the time of the Romans, the Jews were numerous and influential. Many of them asserted that they were descended from the aristocracy of Jerusalem who had been deported by Titus or by earlier conquerors into banishment. You see, by the time the Reformation, Jewish Kabbalists were openly in control of the papacy, the Vatican, from which they directed Kabbalistic operations through Western Christendom. So it's a well-known fact that the Reformation was achieved by Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli. But it's not so well-known that previously John Ruchlin, Pico de Mirandola's disciple, shook the Christian conscience by suggesting as early as 1494 that there was nothing higher than the Hebraic wisdom. And when in 1509 a renegade Jew, Joseph Pfefferkorn, had the Talmud seized and finally obtained, after several attempts, the definitive condemnation of this whole idea, which contained 1,000 years of Jewish wisdom, Bakunin did not shrink from exposing himself to every menace and danger in order to defend the emperor and the pope, the extraordinary value of the Talmud, whose veritable meaning he got, he fathomed. Ruchlin advocated returning to Jewish sources as well as to ancient texts. Finally, he won his case against the convert Pfefferkorn, who loudly demanded the destruction of the Talmud, the new spirit which was to revolutionize the whole Europe, and became apparent to the Jews in the Talmud, wrote the historian Gritz. Yes, you can see the manipulation behind all of this if you just merely look at history. And that's all I do on AVFS. It's the Spaceman, Talk Radio, AM 640. I'm Nevada Call of Spaceman at Talk Radio, AM 640. It's View from Space. This is tonight's final segment in the show. So here's some information that's going to be a shock to you. To all Roman Catholics, really. In 1491, Saint Ignacio de Loyola was born in the Basque province of Spain. His parents were Maranos, and at the time of his birth, the family was very wealthy. As a young man, he becomes a member of the Jewish Illuminati Order of Spain. In a cover for his crypto-Jewish activities, he becomes very active as a Roman Catholic. May 20th, 1521, Ignatius de Loyola, as he was now called, was wounded in a battle, becomes a semi-cripple. Unable to succeed in the military and political arena, he starts a quest for holiness and eventually ended up in Paris, where he studied for the priesthood. 1539 now, he moves to Rome, where he founds the Jesuit order, which was to become the most vile, bloody, and persecuting order of the Roman Catholic Church. In 1540, the current Pope, then Pope Paul III, approved the order even. At Loyola's death in 1556, there were even more than 1,000 members of Jesuit order now located in a number of nations. Setting up the Jesuit order, Ignatius Loyola devised an elaborate spy system so that no one in the order was safe. If there was any opposition, death would come quick. The Jesuit order not only became a destructive arm of the Roman Catholic Church, it's now the army, and they have their first Jesuit pope in Pope Francis installed. It's also developed into a very highly secretive intelligence service on how the world government rules nations. Oh yes, it's a done deal. The New World Order is standing by, even now in the shadows, ready to take control. Just the borders laws have to be changed, knocked down. And the strategy is simple. Attempt to make our enemies suspect each other and then fight it out. It saves the Illuminati the work. Maurice Pinet partly recognized this dialectical process at work. He posited that the crypto-Jewry in the Islamic world accounts for the tumult in the Middle East today. The phenomenon of crypto-Judaism didn't remain only limited to the Christian world. What I mean by that is, there are Jews leaving the Jews who are not Jewish. They believe in the Kabbalah. Enoch's black magic. And the poor Jewish people are mere pawns. You can still find in different parts of the Muslim world, rather, communities of crypto-Jews, as Cecil Ross wrote about, who records several examples of Jewish communities in which Hebrews, who outwardly were Muselmen, but are in secret still Jews. This means that the Jews have also introduced a fifth column into the bosom of the Islamic religion. This fact probably explains the many divisions of the uproar which has occurred in the world of Muhammad. You know what I mean. In other words, having infiltrated the Christians and Islamic worlds, these Kabbalist believers of Enoch's black magic were in a position to implement Protocol 17 in the learned elders of Zion throughout all Europe, and by means of relations with Europe in other continents also. We must create ferments, discords, hostility. Therein we gain a double advantage. Protocol number 17. Cause chaos. To those who hesitate to believe that the protocols of the learned elders of Zion represent a blueprint for world domination by a secret brotherhood, you got another thing coming if you don't think it's true. There's a writer, Cohen, offers some sensible advice. Just this. Many efforts have been made to dismiss the protocols as a hoax. Frankly, it doesn't matter whether they are or aren't because of their astonishing reflection of reality. But once you read them, you can decide for yourself. The Protocols of Zion were first published in Russia in 1905 by Professor Sergei Nilus. In his introduction, Nilus noted that the protocol begins with a reference to the cycle of the symbolic snake by which we symbolize our people. It cannot be overstated, he said, that Nilus misinterpreted the symbolic snake as the symbol of Judaism in general. But Genesis 49, verse 17, specifically IDs, only one tribe of Israel is the serpent. The one I had on and showcased for 4 hours last week, the tribe of Dan. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse's heels, so that his rider shall fall backward. It's important to remember the distinction in order to avoid misrepresenting all Jews and perpetrators of the evil scheme outlined in the protocols, though. So before presenting Professor Nilus' explanation of the symbolic snake, you got to look at what this image really means in the occult tradition. The symbolic snake is the ancient symbol of the Ouroboros, the serpent biting its own tail, making the circle. This symbol bears the inscription Petit Finis Aborigin, which means look for the end in the beginning. Back to the future. This axiom, this group of words, shows you the Gnostic plan to go back to the future. In other words, to go through the same thing, go through time, only in reverse. First to the Garden of Eden, and then back to creation. As the New Age writer Tim Robbins said, our purpose is to return to Eden, make friends with the snake, set up our computers among the wild apple trees, many aren't happy with the plan of salvation that God had ordained. These Gnostics believe that they are gods, and they have devised the alternate plan to fulfill biblical prophecy. So the Ouroboros illustrates the nature of the Gnostic conquest of Christian civilization. In his introduction to the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, Nihlus, the Russian, charted with uncanny precision the geographical course of the symbolic snake that's been snaking its way, like the bloodline, I say, has been throughout history. Protocol 3 opens up with a reference to the symbolic snake of Judaism. In his epilogue to the 1905 edition of the Protocols, Nihlus gives the interesting account of his symbol. According to the records of secret Jewish Zionism, Solomon, another Jewish learned man already in 929 BC, thought out a scheme, in theory, for a peaceful conquest of the whole universe. Nihlus seems to be referring to the 8th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, to whom God gives visions to the temple where the Jewish elders conducted idolatrous rites sanctioned by Solomon, who promoted the worship of Astarte, Diana, the Queen of Heaven. As history developed, the scheme was worked out in detail and completed by men who subsequently initiated it. And these men decided by peaceful means to conquer the world for Zion with the slyness of the symbolic snake, whose head was to represent those who have been initiated into the plans of the Kabbalistic administration, and the body of the snake to represent the Jewish people. This is questionable in the view of millions of Jews slaughtered by the Zionists, by the way. The administration was also kept secret, even from the Jewish nation itself. And this is closer to the truth. As this snake penetrated into the hearts of the nations which it encountered, it undermined and devoured all non-Jewish power in these states. And it's now coming to wrap its slithery body around the entire globe and bite its tail for the final conquer. New world order is coming. The Antichrist is on his way. They're preparing now. And the play-by-play is right here on AVFS. Every Saturday night, right here on Talk Radio AM 640. This has been an AVFS. I'm Space, and Coast to Coast is next. I'm out.